From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at a new method for setting bail.
So the idea of a pretrial tool like this is to actually expedite that pretrial release process.
Meanwhile, a pilot project in Michigan shows low-income people have a harder time dealing with bail.
Most people don't have $1,000 or $2,500 or something sitting around to post for their friend or their brother or their sister or cousin to get out.
Then some Toledo suburbs are thinking about tapping into an aquifer that 20 other Michigan and Ohio communities rely on.
The people know there's water down there, but they're not sure, you know, how much, and they're not sure how sustainable it is.
And why is Michigan the center of the pickleverse?
Temperature-wise, soil-wise, all of that is just great for growing vegetables in general and pickles in particular.
Plus, the end of burning coal for electricity in the Upper Peninsula. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Let's talk about cash bail. Yesterday, the American Civil Liberties Union Michigan filed a federal class action suit to change how cash bail is determined in Detroit's 36th District Court. My colleague Sarah Swick reports the lawsuit alleges defendants often don't have court-appointed lawyers, they don't normally have a chance to make the case to be released without bond, and the court doesn't ask whether the defendants actually have the money for cash bail. The Michigan Supreme Court has had some concerns about setting bail, and it launched a pilot program that centers around a pretrial risk assessment tool called the PSA, Public Safety Assessment. There are a lot of quick decisions judges need to make at pretrial hearings. Questions like, how likely is the defendant to return to court? Or, how likely is the defendant to commit a crime while out on release? The PSA uses a predictive algorithm to help judges make those pretrial decisions. Matthew DeMichel is the director of the Center for Courts and Corrections Research at RTI International. He was lead author of a study looking at the use of PSA in courts in Kentucky. Cynthia Canty recently spoke to him about the public safety assessment process and how it's working.
First of all, just to get everybody on the very, very same page, exactly what is pretrial?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think a lot of people don't understand what that is. And so I think most people have heard the idea that people are presumed innocent, and the idea is that an individual can be arrested, and then they're brought into a jail, and they're booked into a jail, and then they have to go before a judge and have an actual hearing to decide whether they're guilty or not. And so that can be, there can be a long period of time between the time that you're arrested and the time that you're actually either convicted or acquitted of a crime. And so during that period, it's referred to as pretrial. And judges have the opportunity to hold people in jail during that time or release them.
So what is it that this tool, the PSA, the Public Safety Assessment,
right,
what is it designed to do in this context of this pretrial detention?
I think it's helpful to step back. I'm often asked about the PSA, and I think it's good for folks that maybe don't study criminology or criminal justice to step back and to understand that this idea of risk assessment tools, they've been used, you know, since probably the 1920s or 1930s when they were developed to make release from prison decisions. And so risk assessments have been used throughout the criminal justice system for a very long time. They've you know, probably in the 1960s, they got introduced to pretrial with a study after a series of studies that had found that a lot of poor people and people of color were being held in jail because they couldn't afford small bail amounts. And so a company called the Vere Institute of Justice created a pretrial risk assessment that tried to see, could we identify low-risk individuals to be released from jail? And so the PSA does something very similar. It uses, there are 9 risk factors on the PSA. Those risk factors are essentially a series of criminal history indicators. Does the individual have a pending case, meaning do you have a charge open right now? Have you been convicted of felonies or misdemeanors? Things like that are included on the PSA. And the PSA, it's used to develop probabilities of an individual experiencing 3 different outcomes, whether they're going to fail to appear, meaning they miss a court date, whether they're going to commit a new crime while they're out, you know, during pretrial, or whether they're going to commit a new violent crime while they're out. And then it's used as a tool to give further information to judges because the PSA can be scored without an interview. So you don't have to sit down and do maybe an hour or 2 hour long interview with the defendant. And while an interview sounds like a great idea, and it is to learn more about a defendant, it can take a long time for a pretrial officer to be able to get through each person that's waiting to come out or to be seen by a judge, I should say, to be released pretrial. So the idea of a pretrial tool like this is to actually expedite that pretrial release process.
Matt, you looked at a full year of results from the use of this tool in Kentucky, and I will quote your findings of this tool. Quote, you found it to have predictive validity measures in line with what are generally accepted within the criminal justice field. Translate that for us.
Right. So we looked at almost 165,000 cases, and it was actually over an 18-month period from the state of Kentucky looking at pretrial defendants. And what we found is that the predictive validity for the tool was in line with what we're finding in other criminal justice risk assessments, which we used a statistical technique to do this. And we found that about 7 out of 10 times the risk assessment is going to be correct.
You also found the tool to not be so accurate in some areas. For example, its ability to predict the risk of failure to appear for Black defendants. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when you talk about risk assessment, again, it's kind of difficult to do in the abstract. I always feel like I want visual aids to be able to show people exactly what I'm talking about, and the radio doesn't allow for that. But what we found is that for lower scoring Black defendants, we found that the PSA was actually under-predicting. So it was that whereas, you know, overall in white defendants, about 5% of individuals with a score of 1, which is the lowest score, were failing to appear. But we found for Black defendants, about 12% of them were failing to appear. And that was only for the lowest scores on the risk assessment, which ranges from a 1 to 6. We found that those differences kind of, you know, faded away as the instrument got, as the scores increased, I should say. And I think there could be some cultural or structural reasons that maybe prevents people from showing up to court. And while I'm talking about that, I think it's important to understand that what does failure to appear in court mean? It doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's fled the jurisdiction and they've left Kentucky and they've made their way to California by railroad or something. It could very simply mean that somebody forgot to attend one of many court appearances that they may have before their case is adjudicated. And so we know that, and we're seeing this, that many jurisdictions are experimenting with and implementing text-based reminder systems, much like maybe if you go to the dentist or you have a hair appointment, the day before you get a text message or a phone call saying, hey, don't forget to show up, you know, to your appointment. And it's the same thing here with court appearances. And what we also need to realize is that for failure to appear, you know, overall, I mean, 85% of the people didn't miss any of their court appearances. You know, 90% of all defendants did not commit a new crime. And 99% of defendants did not commit a new violent crime during this pretrial period.
As you know, and you address in your study, Matt, the tool has come under fire from criminal justice advocates for they believe it further incorporates historical bias into the courtroom via this supposedly objective algorithm.
Right.
How do you address that?
I think that's a great question, and I think that what we always need to do is we need to always compare to what. And I think, and by that, what do I mean? How are pretrial decisions being made today? I mean, currently we've all heard terms like mass incarceration, mm-hmm. right? And we got to mass incarceration without pretrial risk assessments. We got to large, you know, forms of disparity and disproportionality for people of color from arrest to conviction to incarceration to lengthy sentences without pretrial risk assessments. We are all programmed with various forms of systematic errors or biases in our judgment that are already causing or influencing judges to make biased decisions, and all legal actors and all people, quite frankly. And so it has to do with if we're going to challenge the PSA and risk assessments, which I think we should constantly do. I mean, as a scientist, we want to continually investigate the quality of this instrument, whether or not it is exacerbating bias, and continually do that. I mean, we have to have an ongoing form of empirical research that backs any tool that's used in the criminal justice system. But we also have to have realistic forms of comparison and this idea of, you know, compare to what sort of argument. So I think that's very important. I think the other thing is talking about data. And much of these arguments come from the idea that the reason the PSA and other things like the PSA are biased, according to the opponents, is that they say that bias is built into the data, and it's built into the data due to over-policing of people of color.
Right.
And that, I think there is some truth to that, of course. But judges are already using those data to make decisions. They're just using those data in a very unsystematic way. And can we improve the way that the current data we have are used, and can we also come up with better ways of collecting data, creating better data infrastructure, and creating a system of which pretrial justice systems across the country are continually using their own data to conduct analyses to identify what are the best fitting algorithms for their jurisdiction.
So we've got five district courts in Michigan doing this pilot study. We will let everybody know: Hamtramck, Clinton Township, Isabella County Trial Court, Flint, and Escanaba. So very much all around the state doing this pilot study of the PSA. What should we watch for? What would successful use of this tool look like in your view?
Well, that's a good question. I think that what people need to do is, I think communities need to agree on and discuss what fairness means for each community. We use this term fairness very often, and very often we don't know exactly what it means. But I think each of those local communities needs to be engaged with their criminal justice stakeholders, and those criminal justice stakeholders and courts need to engage the community to understand what they want, what they see as fair. But I think some other things is developing some simple, agreed-upon performance metrics. I mean, you can very easily look at the size and composition of your jails to understand how many people are you holding in jail, what are their demographics, how many, you know, black defendants, white defendants, Hispanic defendants, et cetera, and what are their charges, and kind of rank them by score to ensure that you're not holding a lot of low-risk people of color in your jail and releasing more high-risk white defendants. I mean, I think there are some simple performance metrics that could be used as one thing. Another thing is I think people need to talk to judges and talk to prosecutors and talk to public defenders and defendants and the individuals and their families that are going through the system to understand what is the experience that they're having going through the pretrial system and how did they experience it? What's the lived reality of a jurisdiction that's using the PSA?
Matt DeMichel, director of the Center for Courts and Corrections Research at RTI International. Matt was the lead author of a study exploring the use of this risk assessment tool called the Public Safety Assessment in pretrial decisions. And that is being tested right here in Michigan. His study looked at its use in courts in Kentucky. Matt, thank you so much for your time and for talking with us on Stateside about your work.
Thanks for having me.
We're not finished with this topic. After the break, we'll talk with Michigan Radio's investigative reporter, Lindsay Smith. She spent some time at two of those district courts to get a sense of how the public safety assessment pilot program is working there.
It doesn't say on those failures to appear, you know, maybe this person missed the bus. Maybe they don't have reliable transportation. Maybe they showed up to the wrong court.
Stick around. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Let's continue the conversation about using algorithms to set cash bail. As we heard before the break, there are five Michigan district courts using a pilot program called Public Safety Assessment, or PSA. It's a risk assessment tool to using predictive algorithms to keep or help judges make pre-trial decisions, including whether to set bail. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith spent some time in two of those district courts taking part in this pilot program, and she joins me now. Lindsay, where did you go, and what did the judges there have to say about the tool?
So I went to two district courts, 41B in Clinton Township, north of Detroit, and the 31st District Court in Hamtramck. Chief Judge Alexis Kratt there is been living there and been working in the community for a while. So in Hamtramck, in her court, she says it's made a huge difference because before they had this assessment tool, she was spending maybe 2 minutes, maybe a minute, just sitting down, asking, you know, who are you? What's your age? Do you have a job? Do you have kids? Basic rundown before deciding what to set these people's bond at.
But it was just me trying to figure it out with the person in front of me. There was no real evidence-based practice. Now, with the pretrial risk assessment, it is absolutely evidence-based evaluation, and our probation officer, he is the person who handles all of that, so he's got real data, not just kind of winging it. I think this guy's going to come back. I don't think this lady's going to return without some type of cash bond.
So in Hamtramck, it takes a little more time with this assessment tool, you know, more than 2 minutes. It's like 15 minutes a person. But the judge there told me that time is worth it to her because not every court has the same staffing levels and support for this stuff, but And there it certainly made a difference. Now, these kinds of assessments are new to Hamtramck, but they're not new in Michigan. There are 15 counties and the city of Detroit that have some kind of risk assessment tool.
So there are critics to this tool. What do they say the downside is?
We talked to Shobita Partha Sarathy. She heads the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program at the University of Michigan. Now, she talks about bias against people of color and poor people sort of still being baked into these algorithms, baked into the risk assessment tools.
As with all areas of society, we in the criminal justice system are always trying to reach towards scientific explanations because somehow we see that as objective, as standardizable, and that that can somehow take out human judgment in the system.
Now, I've talked to some folks in pretrial services in other Michigan counties who were really hoping that this tool would make a huge difference when they implemented in the past years. But it's just not the panacea that they were anticipating.
Well, what were the problems in the district courts you looked at?
So the biggest problem that I saw is the tool doesn't take into account why a person didn't show up to court. So if they have a history of not showing up to court, that doesn't look good to the judge, right? Like, how can I trust you to come back? But it doesn't say on those failures to appear, you know, maybe this person missed the bus. Maybe they don't have reliable transportation. Maybe they showed up to the wrong court. Sometimes Judge Kratz says people are just not super organized and they forget because there's sometimes a lot of different court dates to keep track of. And some people have a job where you don't get paid to get that time off.
You know, the financial reality of our community is most people don't have $1,000 or $2,500 or something sitting around to post for their friend or their brother or their sister or cousin to get out. You know, they need that money for something else. So this is a good way to get them back here without taking their family's resources away from them.
Now, you said Judge Kratz lives in Hamtramck. She knows the community. She knows that a lot of the people there can't afford cash bail. So does this mean that this judge has foregone cash bail or cash bond altogether?
So here's the thing. The judges and the magistrates with these pretrial risk assessments, including the judges that are in this pilot program, they are still allowed to require a financial bond, and they do. So one woman that I witnessed in Hamtramck was booked for two misdemeanors, transporting open intoxicants in her motor vehicle. She was not drunk. And driving with a suspended license. She had 7 license suspensions, but no other criminal history, so just driving with a suspended license. But she repeatedly failed to show up to court. So the assessment tool put her at a level 4. That's the highest risk level Judge Kratz said she had ever seen since starting this pilot in January. But that doesn't take into account why she missed court in each of those instances. And, you know, this woman really was pleading with the judge, crying in court, talking about an abusive ex-husband who used to control all of her money, so she wasn't able to pay the fines or show up to court. She said she declared bankruptcy twice to try to get rid of some of this debt that she owed. She finally had a full-time job at DTE for 2 years. She said she was supporting 8 kids, ages 1 through 16. But because of the way the tool set it up, Judge Kratz put a $1,600 cash or surety bond on that. And in some cases, judges don't have a choice on how to set bail. So let me give you one more example. One of the craziest things I saw was in the district court in Clinton Township. A guy got picked up for not paying child support. The tool ran him through the program, right? He's a risk level 1. That's the lowest risk rating. This guy's 90% chance he's going to show up to court. He's got no criminal record at all. He's got a job, but his bail is set at $47,471 cash, no 10%. So there, the magistrate had no choice because state law dictates that this guy's bail has to be $500 or 25% of what he allegedly owes on child support, whichever is greater.
So it sounds like we need more than just a risk assessment tool to really fix things.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely another criticism in this conversation about bail reform, that in order to make any real difference, you have to change the laws, too. New Jersey all but eliminated cash bail through a law. Colorado is looking to get rid of some cash bail for certain charges, low-level charges. John Raefling is a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. He studied a risk assessment tool in California.
These risk assessment tools are being sold as the answer for bail reform, right? The money bail system is a problem because judges set bail and people can't pay and they stay in custody, and that's unfair. But you're just replacing it with another unfair system. If the judges didn't want to hold people in custody, they could just not set bail, right? They've had control over this. You're now giving them a tool that allows them to, with the veneer of objectivity and science, do exactly what they've been doing all along.
Now, he found a correlation between pretrial detention and likelihood of conviction, because sometimes when you're sitting in jail, it's easier to just plead guilty than be stuck there.
Do we have any idea how many people in Michigan are stuck in jail simply because they just cannot afford the bail to get out?
We don't have a straight answer to that. There's no centralized system to collect this data yet, although I hear hints that that is coming or something that may be piloted elsewhere. The best estimate that I could find comes from the Vera Institute of Justice. They compiled the statistics that are available. They show about half the people in county jails have not been convicted of a crime yet. They are simply waiting for their court date. So some are being held because they may be a public safety risk. There are legit reasons to keep people pretrial. So we don't know. We haven't been able to pull those apart. We don't know how many of those people can't get out because they simply can't pay. But the assumption is if you could get out of jail, you would.
That is Michigan Radio's investigative reporter, Lindsay Smith. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
You already knew this, but I just read that Michigan is the nation's biggest pickle producer, by far. I found out in a Crain's Detroit Business article written by Nina Mizoraka Ignazik, and she joins us now. So this idea came from your editor, who, as I understand it, is the daughter of Cy Ginsburg. And so for those of us who don't know about Cy Ginsburg's deli and its relationship to pickles, maybe you could explain that for us.
So Cy Ginsburg is a beloved brand of corned beef. And it's kind of ironic because my editor, his daughter, Amy Elliott Bragg, is a vegetarian. But she came up with this idea as part of Crain's food economy series and really just wanted to focus in on pickles as one way to look at how Michigan's food economy works. She was very excited when her editor said yes to this. So this was like a dream project for her and for me.
So how long have pickles been a thing in Michigan?
So pickles have been a thing in Michigan since before World War I. In fact, they started growing pickles in Michigan around 1907 in the Benton Harbor area, southwest Michigan, and just started growing more pickles, more pickle facilities. And then after World War II, the industry also started growing in the Saginaw Bay area.
Yeah, you were saying that there were two main pickle growing belts in Michigan. I guess those are the two places. Why, though? Why in Michigan?
So Michigan is a great place to grow crops, period. We're one of the most diverse agricultural states after California. We have a 10 million acre agricultural industry here. We have well-drained sandy soil, which is great for pickles. We have high humidity, which they also like. So temperature-wise, soil-wise, all of that is just great for growing vegetables in general and pickles in particular.
So was there a particular ethnicity who came to Michigan and said, you know, what this state really needs is some pickling?
So the pickle industry did get going before kind of the great migration of Eastern Europeans and particularly European Jews came to this country. But when the European Jews came to the country, they brought some of the recipes that we're more familiar with today, like kosher pickles and that sort of thing. So it sort of all builded out itself. It was here before they got here, but once the Europeans got here, they kind of expanded it.
You think of pickles as being pretty robust. I mean, they last forever in the refrigerator, right? We have to remember, though, that pickles are made from cucumbers, and I guess harvesting cucumbers has a really short window. Why is that?
Yeah, so I spoke to a seed expert about that, and he told me that you could be in a field in the morning and the cucumbers aren't quite ready, but by 8 o'clock that evening, they could be ready to go. And for that reason, most of the cucumbers in Michigan, 35,000 acres of cucumbers that we grow here, are harvested mechanically with these giant combines that sort of drive through the fields and scoop up the cucumbers. So it can happen in a very, very short window of time. And for that reason, there's really no farm labor involved in it. It's more labor to sort what comes in from the harvest, from the combines.
I would think that they'd have to be pretty close to the processors, too, if they're such a delicate fruit.
Yeah, so that's sort of how the pickle engine works here in Michigan. The growers get started, and actually in an old Detroit Free Press report that I found, they talked about shipping these cucumbers by tank to Detroit for sorting. But at some point, the processors got smart and started building giant silos, either they're wood or fiberglass, half underground or above ground, out where the pickles are being grown. And so just when, you know, sort of snowballs from there.
These silos are like, that's where the brine is, the salt water?
Yeah, so they're giant vats, basically, of super saturated salt solution that can preserve the pickles for long periods of time. And as those facilities got built and all that infrastructure was there, then more pickle growers would locate themselves close to that and sort of just fed off of each other. And now we have kind of these two centers in the state where there's growers and storage in close proximity to each other.
So they're in the brine, but they're not dill pickle or bread and butter pickles yet. What happens from there?
So from there, the pickle growers and processors will ship them out to various customers, like in the case of Swanson's Pickles, which is located in southwest Michigan. They have two main customers. One is Heinz, which is located in Holland, and the other one is Treehouse, which is located in Green Bay, Wisconsin. And so they ship those out to those facilities, and those facilities will do whatever they do. They'll add spices, salts, they'll cure them, they'll put vinegar in, whatever their unique recipes are. They'll make relish, all of the different things that pickles are used for.
I literally laughed out loud when you said the ugly pickles get to be relish.
Yes. So I spoke with Katie Hensley of Swanson Pickles, and she was mentioning that very, very little of the actual harvest is discarded. Maybe there's just some chaff that comes in from the field, but any pickle can be used for some purpose.
So we're the number one pickle manufacturer in the nation, but how much of the market do we own?
So in 2018, Michigan produced 27% of the harvest in the United States, and that was about 27% more than Florida, which is our next closest competitor.
Wow. One of your sources said something like, Michigan is the center of the Pickleverse. What does that even mean?
So the Pickleverse is something that came from Larry Toper, and it basically just describes this kind of ecosystem of pickle growing, manufacturing, but also kind of the culture behind it and the stories that people like Larry Toper bring from his grandmother, Lily Toper, who brought the recipes over. So it's a culture, it's an infrastructure, it's growers, it's sort of the whole shebang.
Pickling and fermentation of all kinds have become really popular in the local food movement, and pickles range from those kind on the store shelf that we're used to seeing that last forever to refrigerated pickles now, which have been around for quite a while. And now we see day pickles made in restaurants and served with hamburgers and stuff. How are pickle tastes changing?
So I think people are growing in their appreciation for craft foods and for fermentation in particular. I think over the last decade or so, we've all come to appreciate the idea of probiotics. And as Jason Grobel pointed out to me, you know, you may think eating yogurt that you're getting probiotics, but you're probably not. However, if you eat Toper's brand of fermented barrel pickles, which are a little scary, I bought my first jar actually last week, and they're cloudy. They look a little weird, but they taste amazing, and they're full of probiotics. And that's sort of where I think some of the tastes are going. People are appreciating those old recipes and the health benefits that they bring along with them.
What did they taste like?
They're tangy, and it's hard to describe. You really just have to taste one.
Okay, all right. Well, there's another thing for the bucket list, I guess. So where is the future of pickles in Michigan going?
I think the future of Michigan pickles will continue to be kind of this, no pun intended, bread and butter of large processing to supply companies like Heinz and the bigger producers. But there will also be more room for people to experiment with their family recipes to sort of get that out there. The shorter, less shelf stable fermented pickles, I think, are going to be a big opportunity going forward for kind of small scale production.
We've been talking to Nina Mizorakan Ignazik, who wrote an article for Crain's Detroit Business titled Why Michigan is the Center of the Pickleverse. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The last coal-burning plant to provide electricity in the Upper Peninsula ceased its operations at the beginning of the month. It had been providing power for more than 60 years. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner reports.
The Presque Isle Power Plant in Marquette has long been the largest producer of coal-fired energy for the Upper Peninsula. Now the building will be vacant. The state has been moving away from coal energy over the past 10 years. Amy Johns is a spokesperson for WEC Energy Group, which owns the plant.
So a few years ago, the UP was having issues with reliability.
She says the utilities couldn't provide enough electricity to customers.
As part of an agreement with the then governor, Rick Schneider, and many other entities in the state, we came up with a long-term energy solution that was cost-effective and good for the environment.
In March, the company started switching from coal to natural gas. John says natural gas will be more reliable because its facilities can be expanded and add more megawatts if needed. She says the plants will save $600 million over the next 30 years and cut emissions. John says 85 employees have lost their jobs with the closing of the plant.
We have been working with a company called Michigan Works to assist those employees that will be affected by the closure.
Bridge Magazine estimates 15 coal-powered plants have closed in Michigan since 2010, with six more to cease operations within 6 years. For Points North, I'm Taylor Wisner.
Points North is a new weekly program from Interlochen Public Radio. Still to come, don't let the spotted lanternflies, beautiful colors, fool you. This invasive insect has wreaked havoc in Pennsylvania and other northeast states. We'll hear about the damage the spotted lanternfly could cause when it gets to Michigan. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. When you hear about water wars, you might think of the American West. But disputes about water are happening more frequently around here. Think about Nestle in Michigan, an agricultural irrigation which uses a lot of water. These are drawing from aquifers, and aquifers have a limited ability to recharge. If you take out more than comes in, you eventually hit empty. That's the concern about the Machindo Aquifer. It's named after Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. 20 smaller communities are tapping the Machindo Aquifer for water, but it could be serving some much larger cities soon. Here to explain what's going on is Tom Henry, who is environmental energy writer at the Toledo Blade. Tom, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Lester.
So how big is this Machindo Aquifer?
It goes over 9 counties in, as you said, in Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. That's how it gets its name. Probably the biggest community is Hillsdale.
Yeah, I saw it stretches from like Hudson, Michigan to Hicksville, Ohio, over by the Indiana border. That's about 50 miles, and they're all using the aquifer. But now some of these Toledo suburbs are eyeing it. They're already getting water from Toledo system, which uses Lake Erie water. Why would the suburbs want water from the aquifer?
Well, it goes back many years, long before even the Toledo water crisis 5 years ago. There were concerns from the suburbs. First, they were paying much higher rates than city residents here. And they were concerned they didn't have much of a voice in, they had no voice, actually, in the operation of the Collins Park Water Treatment Plant. So when we had the water crisis 5 years ago, the mayor of Sylvania, the largest suburb here, told me they've decided it's time for them to look at what other options they may have, because they feel that they need to have more of a voice and more equitable rates. So a lot of it comes down to power and the rate structure here.
Yeah, money and power, that tends to be a determining factor in a lot of things. So there's this company that plans to drill a well and maybe several wells. Is Artesian of Pioneer a company we know about?
It's been around for a while. They actually proposed a smaller water diversion type situation up in the Frankenmuth area there in Michigan a few years ago, but that ultimately didn't go through. It's owned by, and this is what makes it kind of an unusual dynamic, it's owned by the mayor of Pioneer, Ohio, Ed Kitson. They're responsible and know what they're doing as a business. But a lot of people feel very uneasy about having a mayor of a small town potentially making a lot of money off of selling water to Toledo area suburbs 50, 60 miles away.
So it sounds like it's less about whether it might run the aquifer dry than it is about the kind of political dynamic here?
No, there's quite a number of concerns about running the aquifer dry, because there hasn't been a lot of characterization of it. The Ohio DNR, I believe it was the Ohio DNR or else USGS, back in the mid-80s had done look at it. And at the time, Williams County was petitioning to have this recognized as a sole source aquifer.
What does that designation mean for somebody if they have a sole source aquifer?
Well, if they're designated as a sole source aquifer for a community, there has to be more sensitivity to drawdowns. And at the time, that there was a battle going on with agriculture there over, whether agriculture was going to be drawing down too much and not leaving enough for the residents. To answer your question, people know there's water down there, but they're not sure, how much, and they're not sure how sustainable it is, especially, in an era of climate change that we're in now.
So with this permitting process with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, does it take into account things like, well, we've got 20 cities that are already relying on this aquifer, we can't add anymore? Or do they say, let them have a permit, see how much is going on there before we make a decision?
Yeah, they haven't gotten that far down the road. They would need to, and there'll be multiple agencies involved. They'll be looking at how much water is there, how sustainable the proposal is. Right now, the only thing that's come out is a site that could be one of presumably four or five sites where Artesian or Pioneer, should it move forward with this project, if the site is suitable to drill a production well. And that's what the Ohio EPA is looking at now, just the suitability of site. But the questions about the sustainability and the viability and how much water, those are going to be addressed down the road.
I was reading an article you wrote for the Toledo Blade. Sounds like there's some meetings that are happening. What are the people who live in the cities saying to officials?
Oh, it's out there. There's quite a lot of anger. There's a group called the Williams County Alliance and some other local groups there. It's a recent meeting the Ohio EPA put on, and I had this in my story. They had over 800 people there. They're getting huge turnouts and people protesting. They have a feeling that it's their water and that, this mayor is trying to make money by selling what they perceive as their water to somebody else's. I mean, from a legal standpoint, I've had an expert at the University of Toledo College of Law tell me that, it's questionable if they can legally consider it their water, and then there's a potential for multiple different lawsuits involving all three states and citizens groups and others over, who owns the water. But needless to say, it's on their radar, and they're very they become very empowered and very active on the issue.
What are you looking for as the next development in this story?
Well, first, there has to be a decision if the Toledo area suburbs are really serious about this. Some people are of the belief that they're doing it mostly for leverage in their negotiations for a better deal with Toledo. Others have said it's a lot of trouble and a lot of money to go through to do all these studies and, take it as far as it's gone just for some negotiating leverage. But politics being what they are, anything's possible. The project won't move anywhere until he has customers lined up. He's looking at the suburbs and portions of Henry County and Fulton County, some of the townships there. And even that, then, there would be looking at the viability of laying pipeline 50, 60 miles, building a water treatment plant, and a lot of just the economics of it are going to be, very involved. But right now, that's kind of where we're standing to see the tail that wags the dog, the three Toledo area suburbs, if they are interested in continuing to pursue this or not.
Tom Henry is a leading reporter on environmental issues in the Great Lakes. He writes for the Toledo Blade, and you can follow his blog, Ripple Effect. Thanks very much, Tom.
Thanks a lot, Lester.
Biologists and other scientists are keeping an eye out for yet another invasive species. And they're asking you to keep an eye out for it, too. It's called the spotted lanternfly. One of the states hit hard by the spotted lanternfly is Pennsylvania. Heather Leach is with the Department of Entomology at Penn State, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Lester. Thanks for having me.
So first, where did this insect originate, and how did it get to the U.S.?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So the spotted lanternfly is native to certain parts of Asia. It has a very cryptic egg stage, and so we believe it was imported here on stone, and nobody noticed it until it was able to hatch out in the spring and start feeding on our plants here.
On stone, I would have thought like wood pallets or something. Well, it's interesting how these things get in here, but it's always the same basic route from Europe or Asia and into the U.S. ports, and then it goes wherever it goes from there. How far has it spread in the U.S. so far?
So right now it's just in the northeastern part of the U.S. So the biggest population is in Pennsylvania, but it is spreading to some of the nearby states. So New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia also all have populations.
Can you describe what it looks like? People tell me it's pretty.
Yeah, it can be very pretty, at least when there's not hundreds of them. So a lot of people mistake it for a moth. It's actually a plant hopper insect. So it's a very strong jumper, and they're also very colorful. So both in the nymph stage and in the adult stage, they're bright red in some cases and have these very iridescent white spots in other cases.
So I understand that it can travel, as you said, as a leaf hopper, but it also can travel on wood, I suppose, or stone, as you mentioned. So how does it spread?
Yeah, so they're excellent hitchhikers is what we're learning so far. So they lay their eggs pretty much indiscriminately on any surface. So we're very worried about transport of anything that, you know, we're shipping out of Pennsylvania, but also in Asia. So if they're laying their egg masses on something that we might not know about and then it gets moved to, say, Michigan, that's a big problem for us.
What kind of damage does the spotted lanternfly do?
Yeah, so a spotted lanternfly is a piercing, sucking insect. So it feeds on the plant sap or plant phloem. And it feeds on practically any kind of species of tree and plant, so it has a very broad host range, and it's sucking the nutrients out of those plants as it feeds.
So it's pretty indiscriminate. I understand that it damages grapevines, orchards, your ornamental trees in your yard. How bad could this get?
Well, we're still trying to figure that out, so that's a great question. But so far, we're extremely concerned about ornamental and landscape trees, even forest regeneration. But we're also really closely watching vineyards and damages in grape, and that's where we've seen the worst economic damage so far from this pest.
Tell me about that. What's happening?
Yeah, so spotted lanternfly, so high of populations get into these vineyards, and we start to see depletion of nutrients on these vines. They start to get very unhealthy, and then the following year, with all of that feeding damage, we actually see these vines either don't produce any grapes the following year, or they're just completely dead.
Besides piercing, they also have this excrement, right, that bothers the plants?
Yeah, so as they're feeding, they're getting a lot of nutrients from that plant, but they're also getting a lot of sugar water, and so they're excreting that continuously. And so we call that honeydew, and other kind of closely related insects like aphids will do this as well. But with spotted lanternfly, it's on a whole nother level, and so we see large amounts of honeydew, kind of this sugary water around where they're feeding. So this builds up, and we actually start to get mold growth on top of that, what we call sooty mold. So people's decks, their backyards, their picnic tables, but even the grapevines get covered with this black mold substance.
So what am I looking for if I'm looking for the damage it does?
Well, it's actually very hard to see. So it's what we call an indirect feeder. So it's not feeding directly on that grapefruit. It's actually feeding on the vines and on the shoots of that grape plant. So they're sticking their kind of piercing, sucking mouth part in, kind of think like a mosquito, but feeding on a plant. So it's really difficult to really see the damage until you have a very weak-looking plant.
Are there natural enemies at all or organic ways to keep the spotted lanternfly from damaging trees and crops?
Unfortunately, we don't have great control options at this point. Because it's an invasive, it means we don't have any predators or parasitoids that are going to be attacking it here in any real way. But we are trying to understand what we can potentially bring from Asia that can help destroy its populations here as well.
What kind of preventative measures are being used right now?
Well, unfortunately, there's really no way to prevent spotted lanternfly from coming into your vineyard, coming onto your property. So the best options that we have right now are chemical control.
Well, that gets expensive, right?
It does. It gets very expensive for the homeowner, for the grape grower, and it's really difficult to, you know, continuously make these sprays, because what we're seeing is that even when you kill spotted lanternfly in your neighborhood, you get this reinfestation from the surrounding landscape just a couple of days later. So it's really putting a lot of stress on these people dealing with high populations.
How much can this cost vineyards or orchard growers? I mean, do we have an estimate on how much damage in dollars and cents it's done so far?
Yeah, so we're seeing an almost 200% increase in insecticide application cost from spotted lanternfly alone just in the past 2 years. So per acre cost has gone from $54 to $147 an acre for these grape growers to actually try to maintain control and keep spotted lanternfly from damaging their vineyards.
So when we're talking about an invasive pest like this, I mean, you have this idea that they're just swarming in, but what's it actually like on the ground in Pennsylvania?
Well, you know, you don't really start to notice them until you get to that adult life stage. They get very active at this point. They can fly, glide, hop. So it's actually, in some cases, difficult to go outside of your house without getting smacked in the head with one of them, believe it or not.
Besides the way they look, is there anything else we can do to determine if we're starting to get hit by them? You said it was really hard to see the damage they do. I'm trying to figure out what we should be looking for if we want to tell the scientists and biologists in our area that we think we have them.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the best way to really keep that preventative approach is to look out for the various life stages of spotted lanternfly. So learn what they look like. Again, they're when they're nymphs and adults, they're very easy to identify because they're so colorful and strange looking. And so it's best to really take a look at that next time you go out on a hike, next time you go to the lakes, take a look and try to find this insect. And if you do see it, report it to the Michigan Department of Agriculture.
Is this a matter of not if, but when for Michigan?
Unfortunately, I think so. I'm actually a proud Michigander myself, and I desperately want to keep it out of Michigan. But when we're dealing with an insect population that's this high and also fairly cryptic as its egg mass stage, and it is a good hitchhiker, we end up in a situation where it can get very difficult to control. So it's likely not if, but when.
You know, in some cases, we've seen going back to the country of origin or the region of origin, they've been able to find something that would defeat them. I think they did that with gypsy moths, right? They found something that killed gypsy moths.
Yep.
Is there a way we can do this with lanternfly?
I hope so. So we have some great researchers on our team who have gone to areas in China to look for natural enemies that we can potentially introduce. We actually have two different wasps species that are already in a U.S. quarantine facility that are currently undergoing testing. And we've also found a couple of pathogen species, so fungi that are attacking spotted lanternfly, already in Pennsylvania. So we're really hoping that we can gather as much research as possible and try to use these control methods to really use sustainable long-term control against this bug.
Now, I don't have to tell you, but sometimes we've brought in enemies of a pest, and then they turned out to be a worse problem than the original pest. So how do you guys work with that these days, knowing that that has happened in the past?
Absolutely. That's a great question. It basically means we have to be very careful, and it means that anything that's currently in our quarantine facility has to undergo very long-term intense testing to make sure that it's not going to cause any damage itself. So while we're worried about getting rid of spotted lanternfly, we also have to look at any potential damage it might cause to some of our native insects and even native plants and make sure it won't cause any damage there.
Yeah, that big problem of unintended consequences.
Absolutely, yep. We want to make sure that doesn't happen and do this in the most intelligent way possible.
Oh, man. You're just full of good news. That's Heather Leach. She's with the Department of Entomology at Penn State. We've been talking about the spotted lanternfly, an invasive insect which damages trees, orchards, vineyards. It's not in Michigan yet, but it probably will be very soon, and that's why scientists and biologists are asking you to keep an eye out. Hey, thanks for giving us a heads up about this, Heather.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Joy Horan, Rozzy Jaffrey, Adam Reyes, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.